From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Bird brains are actually quite complex. Robins can hear an earthworm's bristles as they move underground. Flamingos can sense rain hundreds of miles away. The albatross sniffs wide swaths of the ocean for prey. Sniffs. It's pretty amazing what birds can smell, see, taste, touch, and hear. It's not an experience we humans can embody, but it's one that science is beginning to comprehend with observation and data. This hour on Point, we are stretching our wings, our minds, and asking, what's it like to be a bird? You can join the conversation. Can you imagine? What's your question on the bird's eye view, the sensation of flight, the bird brain? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining us now from Sheffield, England, is ornithologist Tim Burkhead, professor of behavior and evolution at the University of Sheffield, fellow in the Royal Society of London, author of The Wisdom of Birds, the Cambridge Encyclopedia of Ornithology. His new book is Bird Sense, What It's Like to Be a Bird. Tim Burkhead, thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom.
Can we really know?
That's a good question. When I was about 10, I told my mum that dogs could only see in black and white, and she turned on me and she just gave me a slightly sad look, and she said, how can we possibly know? And the interesting thing is, you know, at that time, we probably found it very difficult to know things like that. But since then, things have moved on a long way, and we've now got a fantastic armory of tools by which we can know quite a lot about what it's like to be a bird, or indeed any other kind of vertebrate, mammal or a bird.
We're going to dive into those senses and perception. I don't know if that's the right word. I struggle with what the right words are. Comprehension, perception, senses certainly can't argue with. We'll look at the philosophy, too. But, I mean, you take your title from this essay, famous essay, 1974, from the philosopher Thomas Nagel, What Is It Like to Be a Bat? His conclusion was that, no, we can never know. We can't even know what another person feels like or how they see the world, let alone another species. Are you saying we're going to get over that hump, Tim?
I'd like to think so. Obviously, we'll never know exactly what it's like to be another person. But I think, you know, he was a bit pessimistic. And to be honest, he used the bat as an example because the bat is like us. It's a mammal. But he also chose the bat because, unlike us, he thought, bats can't echolocate. And so he kind of used that as a way of identifying the fact that here was a sense that another animal had that we couldn't possibly begin to imagine. But he was wrong about that. Lots of blind people are very good at echolocating. And whilst I was writing Bird Sense, having read this business about blind people being able to train themselves to echolocate, I tried to train myself. And there was one particular room in my university department where when I opened the door scraped along the floor and caused an echo. And I couldn't see into the door, into the room. And I tested myself, you know, can I tell whether there's somebody in the room? Mm-hmm. And over 6 or 7 months that I was doing this, I was 80% right. So you can train yourself. And then there's this amazing story of these blind boys who go mountain biking, making a fantastic clicking sound and listening to the echoes and staying on their bikes, staying on the track.
Echolocation, practically.
By echolocating, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Amazing. Let's bring in the birds. Here's a little bird sound for us. North American Carolina wren defending its territory through song for much of the year. This is recorded in Maryland a few years back by Wilbur Hirschberger, trilling along there. You talk about blind boys clicking and echolocation. What about birds in sight? Let's just start right there. What do birds see, and is it very different by species?
Birds probably have, by and large, a similar visual system to our own, except that for a lot of species, their visual sense is much sharper than ours. And of course, the most striking difference between birds and ourselves is that many birds, not all, but many, can see in the ultraviolet. So they can see colours that we can't see and probably find hard to imagine. So the fundamentals are similar, but birds are generally better. There are very few birds that are worse than us. The one that really jumps out as being spectacularly bad is the kiwi, New Zealand kiwi. But the kiwi, of course, relies on smell and its other senses. It has tiny eyes for the size of its body.
A kiwi, not all about seeing, but that sharpness you described. So when we look way up in the sky at a bird, its prey may be quite small on the ground. Does it have fantastically greater acuity than humans, even if the systems may be similar, or something else?
Absolutely. Much greater acuity, particularly birds of prey like eagles and falcons. People have known that for a long time. There's lots and lots of anecdotal evidence that birds can see things that we can't see just by, you know, we can just judge that from watching their behaviour. And one way that birds of prey are able to do this is by having a slightly differently designed eye from ourselves. So we have a single hot spot in the eye, the fovea, which is the bit of the retina where our vision is sharpest. But some birds, particularly birds of prey, have two foveas. So that allows them to kind of have like a close-up lens and a telephoto lens.
What does it mean on the color front? You said they see ultraviolet mm-hmm. spectrum, and so they can see colors we don't. That's a concept that's hard to grasp in itself. Flesh that out for us. How can we try and imagine what that means?
Yeah, well, we know that the kind of light spectrum goes from ultraviolet through to infrared, and you know, using physics and all sorts of different bits of technology, we can actually visualize those. We know that those wavelengths exist. Mm-hmm. What we didn't anticipate was that birds would be able to see them. And that kind of came about by chance about 50 years ago. People were looking, actually, I think it was at fruit, to see whether certain kinds of fruit reflected in the ultraviolet, and found that it did. And then one thing led to another, and people speculated whether birds might use that to find ripe fruit. From the fruit's point of view, it's very important to be seen, because that's the way mm-hmm. the seeds are dispersed. And so then looking inside the bird's retina, people said, you know, it looks to me as though they might be able to detect ultraviolet. And then people did experiments, and sure enough, quite a number of birds are able to do that.
To the bird in flight with a great range of sight, some sight we don't have on the ultraviolet spectrum, they're flying along. Give us a sense of how, you know, a bird is flying. Why is it going where it's going? You know, we're going to work or to pick up the dry cleaning or to the supermarket. We look at the bird, we think, freedom, freedom. Is it?
They're just busy. They're doing stuff. You know, they're feeding. Sometimes they're migrating. Sometimes they're looking for nest sites. Sometimes they're looking for partners. You know, they have busy lives. Natural selection has shaped birds to be as productive in terms of producing eggs and chicks as they can be. So basically, birds don't spend a lot of time sitting around unless they're sleeping or unless they're digesting a meal.
Eggs and chicks, does that mean it's sex on their mind?
Absolutely. At the right season, of course.
But not always, it's not the only thing moving them, I guess. You describe for us their sense of the magnetic field, which mm-hmm. we are, in those terms, I guess, we are blind, but they're quite sighted, if that's the right word, when it comes to the magnetic sense. What's that about?
Okay, this is one of the most exciting and controversial areas of bird sensory biology that's kind of currently around. In about 50 years ago, people were absolutely adamant that birds did not have a magnetic sense. People made statements like that in textbooks. And then gradually it became apparent that they did. And as time's gone on, the evidence has become increasingly clear. And one way that you can test that, and it's not easy to test. And it's not easy to test because when birds are migrating, they kind of have a hierarchy of senses that they use. Mm-hmm. And these are kind of a succession of fail-safes. So if it's cloudy and you can't see the sun or you can't see the stars if you're migrating at night, you fall back on some other sense. So in order to study any one sense, you actually really need to be able to hold all those other ones constant. And technically, that's very difficult to do. However, by subjecting birds to a reversed magnetic field, and you can do that using a kind of huge magnet, you can get them to change their direction. So the way this was kind of discovered was that if you take a small bird that's in the process of migrating mm-hmm. and you put it into a cage, and people did this as long ago as 1600, the bird will tend to hop in a specific direction. And it's hopping in the direction that it would be flying if it was migrating. So you can put a bird in one of these circular cages, and the design of these cages now has become very sophisticated. It's kind of got a wire mesh top and an ink pad in the base, and the funnel itself, the cage itself, is a funnel made out of blotting paper. So the bird gets the ink on its feet, hops on the blotting paper, and leaves a trace of the direction that it would like to be flying.
And where are they going? How are they navigating? toward the magnetic north, or any point on the compass?
Any point on the compass where they will find suitable winter quarters. So in Britain, birds leave here in the autumn and fly to, say, southern Africa.
Mm-hmm.
But they can use the Earth's magnetic field to help to guide them.
Meaning it's they have a kind of built-in compass is one way humans might understand it.
Yeah, absolutely. And the thing that's recently been discovered, which kind of takes some believing, is that the Earth's magnetic field seems to be perceived through the eye. Now, the experimental work that's been done on this has been done on the European robin, which is rather different from your North American robin, but the same process might be happening in yours as well. And it turns out that the European robin is perceiving the Earth's magnetic field only through its right eye. Now, if you just think about that for a moment, it's pretty amazing, isn't it?
Does that mean they can see the magnetic field like we see the northern lights or something?
Well, probably something like that. So people did experiments where they covered up one eye and left the other one exposed. And if you cover up the right eye, then the bird doesn't respond to a change in the magnetic field.
Wow, the magnetic field.
If you cover the other one up, it makes no difference. So this is absolutely remarkable. And there's lots of discussion at the moment and controversy about what the actual mechanism might be that's going on. So you need light, you need something happening in the retina, and the bird is perceiving this magnetic field to help it navigate.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Sound of the American robin behind us right there. In May in West Virginia, we're talking this hour about the world of birds, how birds sense the world, what it's like to be a bird, the creature that flies. Tim Burkhead is with us. His new book is Bird Sense, What It's Like to Be a Bird. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. He is a big ornithologist, been tracking and following and thinking about birds for a long, long time. Tim, you write in the book about robins being able to hear the rustle of a worm's bristles down in the worm's burrow underground. Talk to us about hearing. That sounds unbelievable.
Okay, well, birds, obviously, because they communicate by song a lot of the time, mm-hmm. and other vocalizations, have to have a good sense of hearing. In terms of worms, you can demonstrate this for yourself very easily. Find a nice big worm in the garden and then just put it on a piece of clean white paper. You can hear it scratching along, and those are the tiny, tiny bristles that it uses to move in and out of its burrow. And birds are able to hear the sound of those bristles along the sides of the burrows, and that's how the American robins in your backyard are able to locate them and catch them and to feed them to their chicks.
Okay, so now I'm picturing myself in the backyard with a worm on a piece of paper. I'm lying prone listening to said worm, and my neighbors are calling somebody. but so when a robin, you see robins just in the last few months around here, they'll be out sort of stalking along the ground. Are they listening then for breakfast?
Yeah, they're probably listening and probably looking as well. And obviously, if the worm was lying on the surface of the grass, the robin wouldn't hesitate to use its visual system to identify it and pick it up and so on. But when the worms are underground in their burrows near the surface, then the robin is listening. And you can see, you know, the way the bird cocks its head. It's trying to just get its ear onto that sound.
We've got a lot of listeners listening from a great distance. Betsy in Lincoln, Rhode Island, you're on the air with Tim Burkhead in Sheffield, England. What's your question, Betsy?
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I was wondering if there have been experiments about what birds, quote, think of human music, because my daughter in middle school did a science fair experiment on that. She thought birds came to the feeder more when we had the door open and music was on, so she put the magic flute on and had singing, you know, and tried to see if the birds came more often, and her results were she thought they did. But I would like to know if there have been, you know, serious scientific experiments.
Tim, does a bird know Mozart? What about human music?
No, it probably does, actually. Birds are actually very sensitive to music. There are people that have played their musical instruments and birds have responded. The most famous one in Britain is a lady called Beatrice Harrison, a cellist, who used to take her cello out into the garden on a summer's evening to practice, and the local nightingale would join in, and she ended up making fantastic recordings with the BBC, a duet between the nightingale and the cello. Absolutely wonderful stuff to listen to. to.
What about birds between their own species? Does one bird song register to bird of another species?
Absolutely. I mean, that's really the only thing that matters to a bird is listening to its own species. Because they might be a territorial competitor, it might be a potential partner, and so on. So they're very sensitive to that.
But what about across species? Is it like human language? You know, I don't know, French and Swahili? You don't comprehend unless you just don't comprehend, or could a bird hear something in the call of a bird of a different species, even if it couldn't make out the details, or...?
Sure. I mean, again, there are other species. There are species where they defend their territory not only against their own species, but against other species that have similar kind of food or nesting requirements. So it matters very much then if you kind of recognize them and can keep them at bay and they respond to your signal. So imagine you're a territory owner giving your song saying, "I live here." And then you hear another species singing close by. Mm-hmm. By hearing each other, they both know that there's a territory boundary somewhere between the two of them, and they'd better respect it.
Here's the deep, booming call of a bittern recorded in Norfolk, England. This is in 1966. Tim Burkhead, you write about birds... some species mating and mating for a long time. Do birds who are familiar with one another know each other by sound? Can they call out to one another and know an individual bird's song?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, territorial birds, again, recognize their neighbors by their song. And I suspect even this bittern with this wonderful, deep, booming call, bittens in neighboring territories will recognize each other. Incidentally, that bittern call is one of the deepest sounds that any bird can make. You know, it's fantastic. People used to think that the bittern blew down a reed in order to make that sound. It doesn't. It does it by just filling its gut, in fact, with air. And I think it's kind of like a belching sound when it lets it out. That's how it makes this huge noise. At the other end of the scale, you've got things like kinglets with very, very high-pitched calls that, if you're kind of getting as old as I am, they're kind of hard to hear.
But the bittern all the way down almost in tuba territory there, could they know down to an individual bird, "That's my mate calling"?
Absolutely, yep.
Amazing. Dave in York, Maine. Thanks for calling, Dave. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How you doing?
Pretty well. What's your question?
Good. So I've got a barn, and it's a pretty big barn, 60 by 40, and it's probably 2 to 3 stories tall. Wow. And I had the barn doors open, this was last week, and the barn doors, when they're open, opening 12 feet by 12. Mm-hmm. And a bird that I couldn't quite identify, I think maybe a starling or something, flies in, and it flies to the opposite end of the barn and insists on trying to get itself out of the barn by getting through a 6-inch square pane of glass on the other end of the barn.
Mm-hmm.
It wouldn't go back. I mean, the barn doors were wide open, and there was plenty of light coming through that way, but this bird may have killed itself trying to get through that piece of glass, and I'm trying to figure out why. You know, the phrase bird brain came to mind.
Yeah.
And, I was not impressed with its intellectual capabilities at that point.
At that moment. Dave, that is a great question, and I've seen that in a barn or open building where Dave's got a 12 by 12 foot door, and the bird's trying to get through a 6-inch square of glass. Take us into that set of perceptions, Tim, that creates that situation.
Okay, it does indeed sound a bit bird-brained, but if you think about it for a minute, birds did not evolve alongside panes of glass. You know, there's nothing in their makeup that programs them to deal with panes of glass. For the bird looking at that hole, I should be able to get through there, you know. And so it just keeps trying. And if you're standing at the entrance of the 12-foot door, the bird doesn't want to risk flying past you. Its brain is telling it, it could get through that gap, even though there's a pane of glass there. So it seems silly and stupid to us, but it doesn't seem that daft to me, really.
But as a human, we can imagine feeling on our skin the sort of sense of open air, maybe even a breeze through that big door that might lead us to turn around. What about the sensitivity, I don't know, of the bird's feathers, its surface? Can't it feel openness?
Yeah, no, that's a very good point. And it certainly can. But I think if a bird's frightened, as this one probably was, those things are kind of pushed to one side, really.
Yeah, we humans certainly have our equivalents of that. I mean, here's a bird that the frantic, right, and maybe not thinking.
Yeah.
Here's something that might be useful in that situation. This is the oil bird with kind of grating call. This is recorded in Trinidad, Tobago by David Snow. South American oil bird uses sound to echolocate. Echolocation from the oil bird. Now, that would surely bring back the presence of a solid surface if it were glass or anything else. How common is that capacity?
That's really rare. There's just a handful of birds that can echolocate. The oil bird's one of them, and then there's some little swiftlets in Southeast Asia that can do it. And basically, they're doing exactly what bats are doing. They're giving out a sound and listening to the echoes and using the echo to judge whether there's space to fly. Now, these oil birds breed in caves in total darkness, and that's the way they find their nesting ledge and the way they find the way through the cave. Absolutely fantastic. If you block their ears up, as people did in the 1950s when they were looking at this, the poor old bird is absolutely useless. They depend on hearing the echoes from those funny calls.
Amazing. Janet's calling from Lake Lure, North Carolina. Janet, you're on the air.
Hello. I was listening to you earlier in your discussion about birds using magnetic field to navigate, and I'm wondering what would happen if, again, as historically has happened in the past, the magnetic field flip-flops from north to south poles. What would that do to bird migrations?
That's a really great question, and it is something I've actually thought about. So I think what would happen is initially there would probably be terrible bird mortality because the birds would get the direction of migration wrong. But one of the most striking things about bird migration is there's lots of variation in the direction that birds migrate in. And so some birds, most of them are going south, a few of them will go north. And those that go north under most circumstances probably die. But in this case, if the magnetic field were to flip...
And what would lead to that? Does that happen? I don't know how many epochs?
Exactly. Yeah, we know that happened, so I'm sure it's happened in the past. Okay. But the few birds that kind of got it right by chance during that event, they would be the successful ones. They'd migrate successfully, they'd breed successfully. Their offspring would inherit that ability to respond to the right new magnetic field. So I'm sure it's happened in the past. It sounds a bit harsh that a lot of birds would die, but I'm sure that that's what happened, and natural selection would take care of the rest.
Boy. Life on Earth, not necessarily very accommodating sometimes. Janet, thank you for that. I got one little bit of more sound on the hearing front. We'll go to touch, but this is the Eastern Whippoorwill, recorded in Massachusetts. And my notes here say each trill of the whippoorwill has five separate notes, although human ears can pick up just three of them, evidence showing birds can hear details in birdsong that are lost on us. So, Tim, even in that recording, are we as humans missing something that Lady Whippoorwill will hear?
Absolutely. So if what we hear is three whippoorwill, three syllables, but if you make a sonograph, a sound picture of that sound, you can see that it consists of five separate elements. So do birds detect three or do they detect five? Well, the interesting thing is that when somebody recorded a mockingbird mimicking the whippoorwill and played and made a sonogram of the mockingbird's mimicry, that also contained five elements. So the mockingbird clearly detected the five elements. So that tells us a lot about the bird's fabulous sense of hearing.
So as rich as birdsong is, it's richer than we poor humans
may
know.
Absolutely, yeah. Yep.
Tim Burkhead talking about what it's like to be a bird. Let's go to Foxborough, Massachusetts, and Richard. Richard, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi. I'm going to get to the main. I think most of us could do without ultraviolet or magnetic skills, but we all want to fly.
Yes.
And I've always been, I loved the descriptions that T.H. White wrote in The Once and Future King about what it might be like to be a shorebird and get up into the wind. And I have been in a hang glider, and I've been in a seaplane landing on the water.
Yeah.
And I thought I felt like a bird, but I'm not sure if in an enclosed glider or a seaplane, What would a human being have to do to feel exactly like a bird, except, of course, for powering yourself?
Fantastic. Tim, tell us, please.
I think you'd have to be in a hang glider, wouldn't you, or a microlite to feel the air rushing past. And even then, you know, this would be a poor substitute for the reality. What you really want is to come back in the next life as a starling and be part of one of those fabulous amoeboid flocks where the birds are swirling around at high speed. People often ask me, you know, how do starlings or other birds in these flocks like shorebirds, how do they avoid bumping into each other? I just think that for a bird, you know, the world is moving a lot faster. Their reactions are a lot faster. You know, when we walk down the street, when it's busy, we don't bump into that many people. We don't fall over that often. Mm-hmm. Imagine that, you know, you speeded all that up. You know, and that's, I think that's how birds in flocks do it. But that would be the ultimate in terms of how it feels like to be a bird, what it feels like to be a bird.
Stick with that sensation of flight for a second. Maybe one angle to think about is the angle of effort. For a bird, how effortful is it? Let's say when it's flapping, not when it's just gliding. Is it like us sprinting, or is it mechanics are such that it's easier than that, like us walking?
Okay, well, obviously it's going to vary massively across species. Imagine a pheasant exploding out of the undergrowth because you've just flushed it. I imagine that's a bit like sprinting. And a lot of birds, you know, if you flush them two or three times in a row, they're exhausted. Yeah. So it's just like sprinting. On the other hand, if you were a red-tailed hawk soaring around on thermals and so on, almost effortless, literally.
What is it in the difference in mechanics that makes it just impossible for us? And we've tried back to, you know, Leonardo and before to strap on the wings and do it. There's something obviously fundamentally different here. What is it just in basic terms in the mechanics?
Yeah, they're called wings.
Well, yes, but we can strap them on and still utterly fail. They must have a very different musculature and apportionment of muscle and weight.
Of course, and the breast muscles that power flight are relatively enormous. We're just too heavy. You know, the size of wings for our weight, the wings would just be preposterously large, and then they're kind of impossible to flap.
So when humans dream or imagine, sounds like Richard has perhaps, of flying, when you do, Tim, here, you're the ornithologist who's watched them forever, do you think your dream of flight somehow equates to the bird's reality of it?
I don't know. I mean, most of my research over the years has been on MERS, what we in England call common guillemots, and they have a very distinctive type of flight, very fast flapping. So here's a bird that actually has quite a heavy body weight for the size of its wings. Mm-hmm. And like puffins and other razorbills and so on, they have to work pretty hard. I can imagine that flying long distances is energetically rather demanding, and you would be kind of puffed out at the end of it.
But people must always ask you, though. I mean, there's so many things we'd like to know, but that's kind of, as Richard says, that's the ultimate, isn't it? That motion through space, freedom.
Yep, absolutely fabulous. I mean, I kind of take flight for granted for most birds. I mean, my feeling is that some of their other senses, like touch and taste and so on, are actually, you know, just much more enigmatic. You know, we see birds flying all the time. Mm-hmm. We take it for granted. Yes, we'd like to do it, but just look at some of these other senses. They're just much more fascinating, I think.
We're going to come back and look at exactly those. Touch, taste, smell, maybe even some bird emotion with Tim Burkhead. Ornithologist joins us from Sheffield, England today. Here's the West Virginia wood thrush. Thoreau called the wood thrush the Shakespeare among birds. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. Mallard docks there in New York State. We're talking this hour about the world of birds, how birds sense the world, what it's like to be a bird, to be that creature that flies. Tim Burkhead is with us, University of Sheffield. His new book is Bird Sense, What It's Like to Be a Bird. Great ornithologist. Tim, what about touch and taste in the bird world?
Okay, well, those mallards are a great example of that. It's very clear that for a mallard, or most ducks, the eyes are placed very sideways on the head. So mm-hmm. when a mallard is feeding, and it can't even see the tip of its beak.
Right.
And once you know that it can't see the tip of the beak, you think, well, how does it know what to eat? Well, it knows what to eat by touch and taste. And some absolutely extraordinary research that was done in the 1970s has revealed the level of sophistication that ducks have. I liken it to somebody being given a bowl of muesli to which you've added several spoonfuls of gravel off the road.
Okay.
You know, if you gave somebody that and said, okay, now sort it out without using your eyes, it would be hard work.
You need to figure out what's a grain and what's, I don't know, raisins and what's this and
exactly.
that, all the little different textures and pieces there.
Yeah, and it would be a tough challenge, but, you know, a mallard duck can do that really almost without thinking. And it does it through fantastic sense endings, mechanoreceptors they're called. And the first lot, if you open a duck's beak and look at the rim of the beak, it's covered with tiny little pits, and each one of those pits is a sense receptor. So that's the first point of call. So when the duck's got its beak in the mud or the water, it's using those touch receptors to tell it something about the texture of the items that it's feeling. And then what it does is it flips anything that it thinks is edible further back into the mouth.
Okay.
And then the food item probably touches the taste buds. Now, we tend to think of our taste, well, we know that our taste buds are distributed pretty evenly over our tongue. And when people first started trying to figure out whether birds had taste buds, they looked all over the tongues of birds and found nothing. And they decided, well, birds couldn't taste anything. They should have just looked inside the cavity of the mouth itself, because most of the taste buds that birds have are not on the tongue at all. And when the mallard flicks the food item that it's taken in the tip of its beak, and its touch receptors are saying this might be edible, it flips it back to a point in its mouth that coincides exactly with a little patch of taste buds.
Mm-hmm.
So then you've gone from touch to taste, and then there are several other points further back. So that it's a kind of process of discrimination. At the beginning, everything might be potentially edible, but as you go back further and further into the mouth, the kind of discrimination is becoming more and more refined. And if it's finally deemed to be edible, then of course the duck swallows it.
And what about taste and smell? Here's a listener who says he's got bird feeders out, used every day by 12 to 15 hummingbirds. Now,
wow.
Probably some sugar water drawing those hummingbirds. How do they sense that it's there? Is that smell? Do they have to come up and lick it before they know? I guess not.
Well, they almost certainly recognize the feeder as a feeder, but if your
really?
Listener were to...
I mean, they know what a human bird feeder looks like?
Oh, yeah, one trial learning. They figure that out pretty quickly. And, you know, you watch another hummingbird, you go, okay, that's a feeder, I'm going to go there. Now, if your listener were to change the concentration of sugar in those feeders, I'm not recommending you do this, but if you did, the hummingbird could use its taste buds to discriminate between different levels of sugar.
Would that be smell, or would that be...
No, absolutely, taste.
Taste coming in and would go for the greater concentration, presumably.
It probably would go for the strongest concentration. Remarkably, we know very little about taste in hummingbirds, other than the fact that they can make that discrimination. And you know, I've been interested in seeing if I could find a dead hummingbird so I could look inside its mouth and just see where those taste buds are located. Nobody's ever done that. When I was writing BirdSense, my editor at Bloomsbury kept saying to me, stop telling people about what we don't know. Tell them what we do know.
Right.
But as a research scientist, you know, I want to know what we don't know, because that's where all the interesting questions lie.
Plenty of work to be done. Thinking about smell, you write about the albatross. Here's the sound of a royal albatross. Studies suggesting the albatross uses a sense of smell, of plumes, of odor over the ocean to help detect prey. What a sound. All right, bird smell. What do we know?
Okay, one of the most interesting things about albatrosses is that when whaling ships were operating, as soon as they had a whale carcass to process, seabirds like albatrosses just came flocking in. And over the years, whaling captains often kept diaries. And one of them, a long time ago, said, you know, we were sailing out on the ocean, not a single bird in sight. And I threw over a bit of whale blubber onto the sea. within 5-10 minutes, suddenly there were albatrosses and shearwaters flocking in towards that. So for a long time, we've known that these birds probably have an exquisite sense of smell and can detect, you know, just a few molecules of the smell of a bit of whale blubber, because often these birds are scavengers and carrion feeders. So they often find their food like this by smell. But more recently, it's been discovered that when fish feed on plankton, the plankton, as they kind of are broken up by the fish biting them, they release a substance into the air. And albatrosses and other birds, similar birds like shearwaters, are incredibly sensitive to that smell and use that to guide them towards food. And all the research that's been done on this over the last 10 or 15 years, a lady called Gabby Nevitt's done a lot of this work, she reckons that there is what she considers to be an olfactory landscape. So it's not, you know, the ocean is pretty featureless, but by using their sense of smell, the birds can navigate using this olfactory landscape. And if you think about it, when you watch things like albatrosses and shearwaters, they often fly in a zigzag way, gliding just above the waves. And what they're doing as they zigzag is staying within the plumes of these olfactory substances.
Wow. These capacities we're talking about, these senses, are they very species specific? These are not equally distributed across all kinds of birds.
No, you're absolutely right. And of course, if you think about it for a second, birds occupy such an enormous variety of ecological niches. And so, you know, it makes sense that something like an albatross has a fantastic sense of smell, whereas something like a chickadee or an American robin probably wouldn't rely on smell to quite the same extent.
Let's go to Sue in Stanton, Virginia. Sue, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Thank you very much. Oh, I'm enjoying this, listening to Tim talk so much.
Oh, good.
And I'm wondering what part all the senses play in the parents, the parental birds, communicating with their young. We're out here on a farm, so we have a lot of shelter. We've got water. We've got ponds. We put a nesting box down near the pond, and it has shade from an apple tree. And I noticed eggs in the nest, and I thought, oh, good, something's nesting in the box. I could see feathers sticking up. And a few days later, I went back, little baby bird mouths are opening. I went, oh, boy. And then a few days later, I go back, and I see little gray tops and cream-colored bottoms on one that was near the hole, and I thought, what's this? And a few days later, I came back, but it was in the late afternoon, and all of a sudden, I'm being dive-bombed, and it was a swallow. I mean, she was after me. She chased me all the way back, and my husband said, well, that's wonderful. We know what it is. It's a type of swallow. He said it could be the tree swallows or the barn swallows, and I tried to go back a few minutes later, and I caught the glimpse of the male, and it was this beautiful sapphire color on his back, and I thought, oh, the barn swallows. And 2 days later, I went back. No, I take it back. 4 days later, I went back. Nothing's in the nest. I was heartbroken. I thought, oh, my God, a snake or something has gotten into the nest box and has taken them. And my husband said, well, that's sad, but we have to get in the car and go. So we get in the car. We go up the lane, a good 60 to 70 yards away from where this nesting box is down in the pond. And all of a sudden, my husband puts on the brakes, and he said, look. And he rolls, pushes the button, and the window goes down. We're 6 feet away from the fence. Here are these little balls of fluff lined up, perfect formation, on the top of the fence wire, and the mother barn swallow and the father barn swallow are feeding them. And I'm thinking, how in the world did they get them up the hill of this lane, lined up in perfect formation on this fence? And we sat there and watched them feeding them for 5 minutes, and then Mike said, well, we've got to go or we're going to be late.
But it all lined up, ready to sing Do Re Mi.
How in the world did she communicate with them to get them in perfect order on top of this fence?
Fantastic story and question. How about it, Tim? What do you say?
Well, I'm not sure about perfect order, but obviously when those young birds fledged, they probably could fly to a certain extent, and the communication between parents and chicks would be largely visual, but also auditory. They'd be listening for each other's calls, and it would be, you know, the chicks are programmed to kind of stay close to mum if possible, so that they would have followed them up the road, and they've got to find somewhere to perch. And I guess if the parents are coming back to one particular point to feed the chicks, it would the others would converge on that. So it looks as though they kind of got themselves really organized, but it's probably just a kind of bit of a random thing in terms of them being lined up. But I agree, it is absolutely amazing the way the parents can communicate with the chicks and keep them together like that. But if they didn't, of course, they wouldn't survive. So,
Well, and you sit on a fence, you are lined up, I guess. You write about the guillemot that you studied for so many years at an island off Wales, and particular birds recognizing one another and calling out to one another from a great distance. Describe that for us.
Okay, this was, in a way, was the starting point for the book. So we call them guillemots, you call them murres, so common murres. Mm-hmm. I'm sitting on a cliff ledge during my PhD in the 1970s, and I'd built a hide very close to some birds. I felt I was almost part of the colony. It was wonderful. And suddenly a bird I was watching, she was incubating an egg on her own, stood up and started to give the greeting call. And I thought, this is ridiculous. They only normally do this when their partner is present. And I looked out to sea, and of course there were hundreds of birds flying around out to sea, but I could see one bird about 700 metres away flying towards the colony, and to my utter disbelief, this bird landed beside the bird that was calling. This bird, who stood up and started calling, had clearly recognized its mate at 700 meters distance. To me, all guillemots look the same at a meter's distance. So something, you know, phenomenal was going on. And birds, and guillemots in particular, were never the same after that. Now, the intriguing thing was that I recognized that something special had happened. But within the kind of framework of animal behavior that I was a student of, there was no pigeonhole to put this bit of information. So I stored it at the back of my mind. And when I started writing Bird Sense a few years ago, I kind of plucked it out again as the starting point. This was what made birds special. This is what made me realize there was so much more going on in a bird's head than we generally give them credit for.
Spotted at 700 meters. That's pretty incredible. And called out to. Ray in North Kingston, Rhode Island. Ray, you're on.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Absolutely fascinating discussion. I recently rescued a wounded mourning dove in my backyard. But one of the I wanted to ask Tim, one of my biggest joys of the spring is to see my two cardinals come back. Is it typical for birds to mate for life, or is that just certain birds?
Tim?
Hi, Ray. That's a great question. There's a kind of folklore about birds mating for life, and a folklore about if one of them dies, the other one will pine away. Well, some birds do have very long pair bonds that might last 20 years. So the guillemots that I study have pair bonds that would last for 20-odd years because the birds are very long-lived. Mm-hmm. But smaller birds, like cardinals, probably only live 4 or 5 years on average. Some might live a little bit longer than that. And a lot of them do repair with their original partner. A lot depends on whether they migrate together or kind of separate. A large number of birds just find a new partner each year. So that does raise some very interesting questions about the nature of their pair bonds and whether there's any kind of emotion going on. But yes, it's common for birds to pair for long periods of time, successive breeding seasons.
May look like the same pair to us, may or may not be the same
pair. That's true.
You've got this great story way back in 1794 of Alexander Wilson. This was an American sort of pioneer of ornithology. And the ivory-billed woodpecker that came into his realm. I wish you'd share that story for us. I thought it was just incredible what happened there.
So Wilson's out in the backwoods and a keen ornithologist. And in those days, no binoculars. The only way to study a bird was to shoot it, sadly. And he shot an ivory bill, didn't kill it.
This very large ivory-billed woodpecker. People say that maybe they saw one a few years ago. Doesn't look like it, probably extinct, but an incredible bird, a big one.
A big, very strong bird. It would be great if it wasn't extinct, but nobody's seen one recently. And he travels into town on horseback with this ivory-billed woodpecker. He says, screaming like a baby, so that all the women in the village came out and,
yes,
and kind of
up.
Thought he was doing something funny with a child. And he ties the bird, or he puts the bird initially in his hotel room and goes off to feed his horse and comes back and the bird has destroyed the plasterwork in the room in its effort to get out. Its beak, you know, is like a chisel,
yeah,
a huge chisel.
Yeah.
And I think the most telling thing about how amazingly strong these birds were was that the piece of wood that they would chop out of a living tree with, you know, was the size of your hand. Yeah. Can you imagine doing that with a hammer and chisel?
No.
This bird can do it with its beak.
And so he's trying to, you know, batter its way right through the wall. He ties it to the mahogany table in his room and goes out again. Tell us that.
And then he goes out again and he comes back and the bird has destroyed the mahogany table in its efforts to escape. For me, that story is wonderful. I mean, it's a sad story because he shot the bird, but it tells us something about the extraordinary strength that this bird has. But the point of telling that story was, you know, the beak is as insensitive as a steel chisel, but inside that bird's beak, the tongue is as sensitive or more sensitive than our fingertips. Phenomenal touch receptors in the tongue.
Combination.
Yeah, amazing.
Right there in one bird. And we only have a few seconds, but emotions? Is that ivory-billed woodpecker, you know, tried to batter down the walls? Emotions?
Oh, yeah, it's probably a cross. Now, I think that my favorite story of emotions was a colleague of mine who was studying gannets. And gannets are monogamous. They paired up, and this paired laid an egg, hatched a chick, and the female disappeared. She disappeared for 5 weeks. And my colleague happened to be there as she came back after this five-week period. And instead of doing a greeting ceremony that lasted 2 minutes, they kissed and hugged for 20 minutes. And that tells me that there must be something emotional going on in those birds' brains.
What a great migration through the world of bird senses. Tim Burkhead's book is Bird Sense, What It's Like to Be a Bird. Ornithologist Tim Burkhead, we can't thank you enough. Thanks so much for this tour.
Thank you.
Great to have you with us. Listeners, great to have you with us as well. Here's the littlest birds from the Be Good Tanyas. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.